Hello and welcome to This Week at the Movies. I'm Matt. Can't hear.
And I'm Eric.
I can hear you anyway. This week's episode, we're going to be looking at Civil War, the latest movie from Alex Garland, as well as the new television series Fallout. Very excited for this episode and for these two things coming together. We'll start with the movie Fallout, or with Civil War, sorry, the movie Civil War, as we get things going here.
I can't hear you.
I know, but I'm definitely submitting. So the movie, which we will take out first, starts with Alex, comes from director Alex Garland. And, you know, a lot has been made about this movie and its choice not to really lay out the specifics of the world. This depicts a United States that is in the middle of internal conflict. There's a group called the Western Forces, which is mostly comprised of California and Texas, and the oddity of having California and Texas come together on anything is kind of intriguing. But then we have them kind of going forward and on the path toward attacking Washington, D.C. We're getting close to the 4th of July. And in the midst of that, we have a group of journalists that drop in. We have a veteran photographer, Lee, played by Kirsten Dunst. She's with her another veteran reporter, Joel. They work for Reuters. That's played by Wagner Moura. At the beginning, we see them drop into a situation in New York that quickly turns violent and then soon turns deadly. And there she encounters a young photographer, played by Kelly Spaney. Lee is able to get her out of harm's way, and instantly this young photographer who has idolized Lee, who's a relatively famous war photographer, just feels a connection. We see while Lee is out there filming the scene, she is there, young Jessie is her name, is taking pictures of Lee, wants to be her, wants to be in this world. They go back to their hotel. They're trying to decide, Joel and Lee have decided that they're going to make a play for Washington, D.C., where they're hoping to get the president, played by Nick Offerman, to go on the record before the Capitol is attacked and presumably falls. An older veteran journalist decides to tag along. His name is Sammy, played by Stephen McKinley Henderson. Later, after Lee slips off to a room, Jesse is able to convince Joel that she should come along on this trip. And so the next morning, setting off from New York, trying to make their way to Washington, D.C., is these four journalists who travel through kind of the wreckage of the country. We see the effects, the different reactions people have, the way that this has taken a toll, all leading to this ultimate climax. And the movie is apolitical by choice in that it doesn't try to tell you what the political issues are on either side of the conflict as they prepare to kind of go through all of this. It's more about ideas. And it's very powerful. It's very well put together. Alex Garland, if you followed some of his work, he did Ex Machina. He did the TV show Devs. He did the film Annihilation. These all probably sound like family-friendly films to you. So it's not that surprising that he would wade into something heavy. I was really moved by the beautiful use of cinematography, the way they shot it, and the use of sound, particularly when and where they use score, when and where they use silence. And we get some exceptional performances, I thought, including I was really moved by Kirsten Dunst and Kelly Spaney and the way they play off of each other and some of their back and forth and some of these big ideas. This is a movie, I'm giving it two thumbs up, which, you know, it's probably only the second film this year so far that I've gone with two thumbs up. And to me, it is right behind Dune for me, Dune 2 right now for me in my rankings for the year. I was blown away. I know other people have struggled And I feel like their struggles really don't have to do with the movie that we got, but what they wanted in a movie called Civil War. Maybe they wanted something akin to our old Civil War tales we get, you know, where we have the South and the North, and we clearly know their positions, and it's all about slavery, and, you know, we can decide who the good guys are and who the bad guys are. Although, if you read things like The Killer Angels or watch the movie Gettysburg, it's never that clear cut, and it's not going to be when you have these internal conflicts. For me, this movie was about the idea that if we continue to live in division and strife, we won't avoid the same fate that befalls nations around the world. In fact, we get Lee in the middle of it talking about her time as a war photographer, saying every time she chose to be in peril and to go into a war zone and to take that picture, she sent it home as a warning. And now the war has come home. Later, you hear her explain their job to Jesse. She says, it's not for me to see all these things and start asking myself the hard questions on what I need to do next. I need to present this evidence and hope that other people ask themselves the hard questions to stop it from happening. Mm-hmm. Eric, how did you feel about this movie?
Can you name what your favorite war movie is other than this?
Favorite always sounds weird when you're talking about war movies.
I know.
I'm going to say Saving Private Ryan.
Sorry. So Saving Private Ryan, you know, is classically about the political ideologies of America versus, and goes into depth exploring the political ideologies of Germany, and is clearly about that, right? No.
There is actually a lot of discussion about why they fight.
Okay, but it's still incredibly personal. In fact, almost every story I know of anyone, there are always two areas of conversation. And so I would go so far as to say this movie is not politically ambiguous or apolitical. I think it is very much a commentary on a larger picture than the central conflict of political discourse in the country. And I agree with you that this is a warning, and I think a very truthful warning from most other accounts and messages of what it means to have been through a war. People who go into this complaining that they're not explaining why the country is fighting on one side or another, you don't have to. Everyone in the back of their brain knows that Texas and California, in your mind, it springs to mind two ideologies. The idea that both of them would have wanted to secede for different reasons or the same reasons is such a perfectly ambiguous start just to get everyone who watches the movie on board with the same idea, which is there is a disagreement, and it is important that you not get caught up in what that disagreement is, but there is one that is truthful that could cause a war-torn conflict on our home turf that is widespread. And the commentary that is there about just opening the movie with the president trying to continue to send messages about America's success in the middle of what you end up actually seeing practically is such a pointed response at how the political machine works in the country. And like, it's something that like doesn't totally make sense and click, because you jump immediately from this message of like, we're on the verge of victory, and he's like stumbling over that, to even though these are Western forces, you're in New York and there are riots. It's immediately from the get-go, I started getting this idea of like, and Kirsten Dunst is outstanding in this movie because she is at once exhausted and driven by purpose. She is over it and potentially hopeless about the idea of there being something here. And yet she feels like there is so much importance and value in capturing the truth. And it raises this central question of why risk your life and do this? Why not just work on survival if things are so bad? And I feel like the answers the movie gives you through the characters' choices are immensely satisfying. I love one scene in particular. There are so many like wrenching scenes, and visually, Alex Garland, I'm so upset to hear that he doesn't want to actually direct another movie, because between this and Annihilation, like those are two of the strongest, thought-provoking, grounded, like, I don't know. It just, he's incredible. But anyways, I'm losing track of what I'm saying. Sniper. That instant, there are two soldiers There is a sniper stopping our protagonist from moving forward. And the two soldiers are sitting there and the characters are saying like, hey, whose side are you on? Whose side are they on? And like, they're trying to shoot at us. We're trying to shoot at them so that they don't shoot us. And it is just, it's a reflection of so many accounts of that other side of these two aspects of any war story, which is one, I fought for my country in these ideals and for this thing to move forward. So we do talk in the Civil War on one hand about slavery, and we do talk about World War II on the one hand about the Axis powers versus everyone else. And on the flip side, with the Civil War, you talk about brother versus brother and interfamily fights. And on the other hand, you talk about there was a comment recently, the British saw that the Germans were building a false target landing strip at one point in World War II, made out of just like all wood structures. And the British government let them continue to spend all their time and resources building the place, even though they found out it was a decoy. And when they were done, sent a plane and dropped just a fake wooden bomb on the town. You know, like, and that's, someone else is telling that story to talk about like British humor and all this kind of stuff. But there's this whole idea of, in that moment, no one is taking the larger picture seriously. They're human beings are still individuals, no matter how much they want to be grouped into a collective. We started this year with a movie called Origins that talks a lot about this. And I feel like this is sort of a continuation of this thread, pointing out to people, you want there to be a good guy and a bad guy so that you can think that you're the good guy. That's what escapist fantasy does. And that's the other thing that we're going to talk about today does. It gives you some gray areas and it gives you things to explore that are almost tangible. You can get the sense of what right and wrong is and who to be on what side. At least enough to choose a side. But here you don't, because I think that's reality. I think that is the whole point, is if you're come out of this movie and you're thinking like, oh man, I wish that I could have been able to choose a side to root for. Good luck if this ever becomes reality, because it is not going to get any simpler. And I think if you're in any way disappointed in the way war is represented, imagine how disappointed you would be if you actually had to face like a real war. I thought this was a full two thumbs up, amazing snapshot. Don't mean that to be a pun, but I mean literally just, what does it mean for us to be at war? And then there's some deeper things in there when it comes to the personal relationships and caring about the core characters and why they do what they do. And just that the passage, like the climactic moment of what happens between Kaylee Spaney and Kirsten Dunst. Oh, it was like gutting. And it just, I don't know. I don't want to spoil too much of anything, but just, this was surprisingly easy to watch and beautiful to watch. The pace was like thorough. The movie is not too long. I think everybody should see it because I think people should have to digest how they feel about it. And yeah, I absolutely was blown away. So,
well, I only think it's apolitical in the sense that it doesn't ascribe solid political positions to every, you vaguely know that Nick Offerman's government started killing reporters.
Yeah.
Which is not a great sign. You also vaguely get the impression from a haunting scene with Jesse Plemons that Nick Offerman's forces, platform might be a touch on the racist side.
Well, but see, even that is a question of whether or not this person is acting under orders from the government. Like, I mean, everything there are seeds of that, enough that you can take away those kind of things. But that all of that is thrown into doubt before they walk up to them.
The town that they drive through before that we decided to stay out of it. You are meant to draw the implication.
I will say, I don't think it's subtle at all that Jesse Plemons is wearing red glasses, so that all his vision is red.
Well, and also, if you looked at some of the refugee camps that you're shown and the predominant makeup, even that early scene in New York, if you looked at some of the makeup of the different sides. So there are some subtle hints, but that is somewhat beside the point. If we all sat here today, we could probably imagine what are some of the, we all lived through January 6th, 2021. So it's not hard to imagine what some of the issues would be that would divide, are dividing, have the potential to be, you know, a powder keg. And we've gone through those things, you know, in different points in time. One time we actually had a 5-year war, but there have been other times, you know, I mentioned to you off air, I just read a book about Medgar Evers, and a lot of the discussion of some of those summers in the early 60s in the South talk about it in a point in time where the government was worried we were about to have some kind of civil war or civil unrest because of the violence and the protests. And, you know, there have been points in time where we've come close to fracturing on different things. So it's not hard to imagine what's, you know, I think where it's making some of its points, and it's particularly coming out during a year where we're likely to have a very contentious election season. The last time we had an election, we really did darn sure come close to some kind of, I mean, we did sort of have an armed insurrection. It's hard to call it anything else. We came pretty close to wondering whether that was going to be on a wider scale than it ended up being. Fortunately, it wasn't, but those kind of things are always floating in the background. And, you know, you don't know what happens if somebody gets elected. There are a lot of, you know, I've noted that we've gotten an uptick in Holocaust stories in the last 12 months that seem to be coming around. And it's not just because we should always remember what happened, because those that don't remember history are doomed to repeat it. But I think we're particularly getting World War II era things and Holocaust things pushed back repeatedly into our consciousness right now, because in some way people are worried about things. I would also say, if Alex Garland had chose to clearly spell out political points of view, this film would have done nothing but further polarize people and audiences and fracture the nation, which is what he's trying to advocate against. Because then it would have been about you love the movie because you know, you think people who believe this way are wrong, and I'm going to boycott the movie, or I hate the movie, or the people that like it are wrong. He purposely is trying to avoid that, because that's the exact kind of sentiment he doesn't want you to get into. I remember right after Barack Obama was elected in 2008, a documentary called Right Feeling Wronged, where a person had basically gone on the campaign trail with Obama and McCain in the South, just interviewing people at those stops. And I still remember that 16 years later, because it shook me to hear people in our country and the way that they were talking about political candidates or our actual president, and the lack of reverence, and talking about, I mean, if you ever combine this documentary, there are people that talk about, well, better not come here, else they'll be hanging from a tree or something.
Right.
Those people exist in our country. And if we are not willing, and that didn't go away by all accounts, that might almost be getting worse in 2024, as hard as it is to believe.
It's at least coming out more.
And if we aren't willing to acknowledge that and to try to do something to overcome it, these are the kind of like tinders that get stoked that create a fire that we, you know, that's why Lee, as a veteran war correspondent, is talking about all the war-torn places she's been and seen all these countries thrown into division and chaos and violence. And that she always took those pictures, sending them home as a warning, don't let this become us.
Yep. Yep. Everybody thinks that if they were going to go to war, that they're going to end up fighting the person they disagree with. But the truth is you're way more likely to be fighting the person next to you and you're not going to know why. And
sometimes it just ends up being like blind hate. That's a little bit, I'll be honest. I love this movie, but the last 20 minutes were probably my least favorite part. I get what they were doing, but that ultimate, conclusion and where we end,
that
is not as satisfying,
as
you want it to be. And, but that's probably part of the point too. You're supposed to sit in your discomfort.
Well, I think there's something that is lingering in my mind that is going to make me really want, I really want to rewatch this like immediately, is who is Reuters publishing for?
Reuters is actually a news service.
I know, but like, are they
part of
Canada?
It's part of the AP. So
no, but I'm saying in this world, he finally got his soundbite from the president. Who is it for?
Well, so like Reuters news service gets picked up by every major publication
in the world?
Yes.
Okay.
And also in America. A lot of things, if you actually looked at, I don't know, people don't read newspapers anymore, but you would see it credited to Reuters. Reuters is a news, is kind of like an Associated Press news service. You put it up on the wire, and then people that want to have they pay for the rights.
Yeah, so then I could see if they had leaned a little bit into, I used to have to warn our country about what's going on in the rest of the world. Now I want to warn the rest of the world about what's going on in our country. Mm-hmm. If there had been a little bit more of that, because otherwise, by the
time I thought it was actually pretty brilliant, other than Sammy, who they make allusions to works for the New York Times, even the reporters don't have an affiliation. Because if you name check an actual publication, that too brings a certain connotation. No doubt when they mention New York Times, it.
Right.
It hit for somebody, it hits for people how they feel about those publications. But I think it's also very telling in the kind of in the climate in the world we're living in right now, everything gets ascribed to a certain political point of view, whether it's really meant to be super political or not. Everything's become political. Everything falls down on a certain side, you're before or against. And I actually think that's what's driving some people crazy with civil war, because they want to know what perspective, who is Alex Garland pulling for in this election? He's pulling for America. So
100%. I mean,
the fact that you're freaking out about this is part of the problem. And I think that's even the reason that those guys work for Reuters, because it's not a specific publication that's going to bring with it a whole bunch of baggage. If the guy said he was going to shoot the interview for Fox News, that conjures something. If he says he's going to shoot it for CNN, that conjures something, and that instantly sets people of, it changes your outlook and your point of view. And he did everything he could to be as neutral as possible, to focus on the actual idea, which is what should be bringing us together should be greater than what is tearing us apart. And if you lean into what's tearing us apart, if you lean into the lack of truth, if you are willing to wipe out objective journalism, if you are willing to shield yourself from like that town that just, from what we see on the news, it's better just to stay out of it. We're just going to do our thing and hope it doesn't touch us. Well, let me know how that works out for you.
Yep.
Yeah,
it really has every view. But that's the thing I want to say for everyone who thinks that this movie isn't trying to do something it should try to do. It would have been so easy to pick a side and gain a ton of traffic and attention for this movie, because it wouldn't matter which side they would pick. People would be in an uproar about it. They didn't do that on purpose. And I think it's a huge thing for Alex Garland, like, point in his favor, that is so a part of the point of the movie. if you think it was supposed to be something else, it could have been, and that would have been an easy way to grab a ton of early box office tickets, like sweep people in because everyone's mad at the movie or thinks that they need to watch it because they're defending their rights, or like, oh, it would have been so easy, and they didn't do that.
I mean, and we've seen that with films. I saw the movie Sound of Freedom. It's fine. Mm-hmm. I don't know how accurate it was. But that there is a film that very specifically was leaning into a specific political profile, and they made it well known out there, and that's what drove box office. This movie is trying desperately not to get caught up in that. It wants you to appreciate the subject and to make up your own mind. It wants to have debates. It wants you to be talking about it. Mm-hmm. You know, and we'll see how effective it is. It looked like it was doing decently on the box office. I also just think this is not, unfortunately, a part of the problem is a lot of people in our country don't really want to do that.
Just please, Alex Garland, keep writing for movies and find a director you trust and stick with them so that you still have a distinctive voice visually. Because
And you never know. After a little bit of time, he may go back to, you know, wanting to
maybe
to direct. I wouldn't. We've seen people. I mean, I remember a few years ago, Soderbergh said he was done directing, and then he did some television projects, and he's done some movies, and he's still directing things. You know, we'll see if Tarantino really hangs it up. I think they get frustrated. They go through a lot of these things. They feel like they're curbed down, and sometimes those feelings ebb. And
well, see, I can see Tarantino writing books and being satisfied. I can see Soderbergh not being able to let go of the idea of like a new fun technology or the process of making like something or doing something. Alex Garland is the kind of person who worries me because it feels like he it's so important to him what he's making the movie about that when it lands, if it doesn't land right with after all of that struggle, it's extremely like personally gutting. And I can imagine getting extremely deep bones exhausted, like with a movie like Men, you know, like you try and that movie lands with the reception that it got. And you feel like the people you tried to speak for didn't want you to speak for them. And like, it's just so undercut. Like
that's not the movie I'm going to try to defend though, because I've actually seen it.
I wouldn't see that's the thing.
And that's a tough, you know, not everything lands.
But Annihilation also alienated some people who didn't totally understand it, aren't into science fiction. But I think that movie is a borderline masterpiece.
Devs struggled because it got released in the wrong period of time when we were kind of in the midst of COVID and streaming service changes.
Yeah. And he also
kind of an underrated gem.
A movie that has a weird lot going on to it. I want to point out that he's responsible for writing 2012's reboot of Judge Dredd called Dredd. And a closer look at that, like thinking about his influence over that, like I don't know. It's I just hope he keeps working. Just keep working.
It's been a big month for shows and movies so far. You know, it's been exciting in April, kind of turning a corner here. Which, you know, before we get out of here today, we don't always look at the small screen, but it seemed like these two things would be kind of well paired together. And this is one of the bigger things that came out this week. On Thursday, the new Prime Video series Fallout dropped in its entirety. I think it actually dropped on Wednesday night. They couldn't even wait all the way till Thursday. It's 8 episodes for the season. I assume that they have the potential of making more seasons. It is based on the popular video game. It was adapted for the small screen by a couple of writers named Genevieve Robertson-Dworet and Graham Wagner. And it has pretty pretty good producing group. Among them are Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy. You probably heard the series kind of more accredited to them. They've done a lot of projects. Jonathan Nolan obviously was a producer and a collaborator on a lot of his brother Christopher Nolan's films, but they also did the series Westworld and have done some other things. Jonathan Nolan actually directs the first three. There are 8 episodes. We're going to talk about the pilot. Today, I've seen a couple. All 8, as I mentioned, are available to stream. The pilot, about 75 minutes, a little bit longer than you might expect, but it introduces us to the 3 primary characters who are pictured here. We start in the 1950s, just in the shadow of World War II, as kind of the Cold War and nuclear proliferation is taking off. And it isn't long before you see these people kind of at a serene upscale house in Los Angeles at a birthday party, have the news on. You know that there's a lot of fear that there's going to be nuclear weapons set off. You know, they're watching a newscast. The weatherman says, what's the point in giving the 7-day forecast when we might not be here in 2 days? And as the kids are enjoying a little cake and some fun, you see the unmistakable flash reflected behind them in a window. And pretty soon you see a number of big flashes as nuclear weapons are detonated in Los Angeles. A nuclear cloud sweeps over and destroys everything. Flash forward 219 years into the future. As those bombs were falling, you saw kind of a disparity between the affluent who were able to go into bomb shelters that they had created and the people that were going to be left to struggle for themselves. 219 years later, the surface is still a little radioactive based on the hints we're given, but is somewhat habitable. But there's also a class of people who think that they've saved humanity living in a series of underground shelters. Lucy, played by Ella Purnell, there in the center of the picture, is the daughter of the guy who is in charge of shelter number 33, and that happens to be Kyle MacLachlan. And they're living underground. We see Maximus, who is there to the right in the metal suit, as part of a steelworkers group who helps to, it's really unclear a little bit to me, still in the pilot, exactly what they're doing. They seem like kind of a military scavenging group, seem like they're trying to keep some of the peace on the surface, which is a little bit wild and a little bit lawless. And then there on the left, our third character we're introduced to is titled Ghoul. He was once Cooper Howard, a somewhat famous Western actor who is actually present in the opening sequence when the bombs fall on Los Angeles. And even though his visage has changed, somehow in some form, he is still alive as a bounty hunter 219 years later. All 3 of them are kind of brought together for different reasons, drawn to a scientist who holds the key to bringing Los Angeles back. And so they're all making their way back to the coast. I thought this was impeccably shot. That opening sequence when those bombs drop, it was a big year for the Nolans and nuclear weapons. You know, his brother Christopher showed the creation and the first, you know, the first drop. Jonathan certainly got some of them in there. I really like the way this was done, but I'm going to say I'm giving it 1 thumb up. I've really enjoyed the pilot, and I saw the second episode, which kind of keeps that going and deepens the story. Some of the plot points I mentioned might have been from the second one. That's hard for me to remember. They blend together. But I will say one thing I appreciated here is there was a little bit of lightness and humor, which sounds odd to say in something that's about the fallout, literally the fallout of a nuclear holocaust. And that's how I actually discovered this wasn't written by Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy, because while I have enjoyed them as creators and I loved Westworld, I would not call that show particularly funny. Mm. I don't know if you ever saw Westworld.
1 and 2 seasons, and then the second season gradually got confusing and frustrating for me, and then we started season 3, and I fell off.
Yeah, they also did a show called Person of Interest that was on CBS that I enjoyed for what it was. That also had Michael Emerson, who pops up here, and Jim Caviezel. But again, would not have particularly called that funny. But this one I thought has a little bit of humor and a little bit of life to it. You know, how could you not when you got Walton Goggins in the mix? But I enjoyed this. What did you think?
I love Walton Goggins. That's the first thing. I was like, when I realized it was him and he was getting to lead something, I got so excited. Also, at the end of season one, they show a preview for the rest of the show, and I did not know Matt Berry is in the show. I am a super fan of Matt Berry. And really, just this whole cast. Like, I everybody serves like a function. And that's the strength in this is in balancing three different tones and three different sort of flavors of show that all have to do with a post-apocalypse. One of which seems tied to like your Western gunslinger type thing. One of which seems tied heavily to the video game and the idea of like a trapped in the 50s post-apocalypse survivor type situation. And then your sort of Halo mech militarized sort of thing. So whichever of those seems to appeal to you, none of the three of them stray too far away that you won't enjoy the other two, I don't think. Everything really does feel like it fits in the same world, and I'm so excited to see the main characters sort of come together and have things balance out. I was way surprised by this. I've never played the games, so I knew some of what to expect kind of tonally, but I didn't expect to enjoy the concept so much. And just, I love that I've seen a lot of things about the creation of this where the creators weren't too worried about direct adaptation of the source material and want to take liberties with it. And as long as that comes from a place of, I have a story that I'm passionate about that just so happens to fit this IP very well, I don't think you can go too terribly wrong. Again, Jonathan Nolan is not the writer. So even though I think I like pretty much everything he's written, except for when...
Yeah, so here I'll give you... These are the... There's only eight projects he's been credited as a writer.
Co-writer. That's...
Yeah, co-writer. Too. Memento, The Prestige, The Dark Knight, one of the greatest films ever made.
Specifically that line, you either die here or live long enough to see yourself become a villain. Christopher Nolan talked about that recently. Like that, he didn't write that, and that drives him crazy.
There's some TV series that he wrote an episode of called Hey Ash, What You Playing? I've never seen that.
Hey, that's an internet thing. That's interesting.
It says original screenplay. Oh, I guess it says a TV series. The Dark Knight Rises, Interstellar, and then Person of Interest and Westworld, their two series. I just looked at Lisa Joy. She actually, I have to rescind that. She has done some, she was a writer on Pushing Daisies.
Oh, okay.
And I would definitely say that that was something that had a sense of humor, that had a lot of style and nothing but a sense of humor. She's only a credited writer on a couple of things. One of the other TV shows she worked on is Burn Notice, which definitely had its had a sense of humor. But then she did the film, they kind of did it together, Reminiscence. I don't know if you remember that from 2021. I would not say that was particularly funny.
Yeah, and they're not the writers for this. But that's the thing. Seeing Jonathan Nolan and knowing he was such a key part of the team of all those Christopher Nolan like early works and some of his bigger works is like... I think it's really exciting to kind of see him working under the radar, pulling up these projects. But here's my thing about Westworld. No matter how good they were going to do with the concept, taking the concept outside of Westworld and deciding that the interesting thing about that concept is not the park and the ethics of what people do in the park was just a huge misstep for me. And so at the end of season two, it was a huge ask for me to be invested in like, what's the world outside look like? And what do real people do like on a day to day and like how they were supposed to have AI advance and all that.
You know, what's interesting, it had to have been some kind of a true collaboration. So I'm looking at the two people who are the creators of the adaptation and
Fallout.
Yeah. Genevieve, Dorit was a screenwriter for the Alicia Vikander Tomb Raider and for Captain Marvel.
Okay.
And Graham Wagner was a writer and writer for the American version of The Office, the series Baskets, the series Portlandia, and the series Silicon Valley. So I know where the humor is coming
from. Wow, that's exciting.
So now, you're talking about, you know, talked about Nolan and Lisa Joy, they have definitely worked on kind of the science fiction and the, so you can see the kind of marriage of visuals and then different kind of storytelling.
Also, video game kind of originality.
Backgrounds, yep. So just kind of an interesting mix. And this was obviously a really high profile project for Prime Video, one of the big ones that they have out there. A lot of stars, obviously a product. I've never played Fallout, but I am familiar with it being a video game, and I know it's a very popular video game.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I enjoyed it. Be curious to see how this first season ends. Do you think you're going to finish it after the?
I really think I am. We've finally finished Echo, my wife and I, and we're making our way through some things. The biggest thing that we're hyped about right now, week to week, is X-Men 97.
Mm-hmm.
That last episode
was a very emotional, unbelievable episode.
Yes, it was.
But you know, I thought that was interesting too, because you know that one of my criticisms of the MCU, especially when we've talked about some of the past ones, is their lack of stakes.
Uh-huh.
This would be one of the first like Marvel projects shepherded by the MCU that you can't say it doesn't have stakes, because they're mm-hmm. willing to pick right up with Charles Xavier dead, and it sure looked like a couple of them got in the mm-hmm. in the most recent episode as well, which is
now, I gotta say, the soap opera drama of I have a clone, I'm back from the future, an alternate universe me is here to replace me from the dead. People come back from the dead all the time, but for right now, I don't care, because the emotions worked, and that episode is great. Whatever people feel about what Gambit and Nightcrawler are my two favorite X-Men, favorite characters. Whatever happened to Gambit, I don't care, because the episode was so good. I'm sort of echoing a friend.
We'll kind of see, and hopefully kind of gives you an interest, you know, when they at some point they are going to bring the X-Men back onto the big screen. And I've always loved the X-Men. I think getting a clean start is probably good. Not that there isn't ones out of the 20th Century Fox run that I really liked, the original one, X-Men 2000. X Squared was not too bad. X-Men First Class, as you know, is one of my favorite superhero movies of all time. I like Days of Future Past. I even moderately liked Apocalypse. Mm-hmm. Every time they've tried to do the Jean Grey story, maybe don't let Simon Kinberg work on it when you try to tackle it again. That Phoenix Jean Grey has never quite worked in films. I'm curious to see what they're going to do. There's a lot of rumors that we're going to that part of Hugh Jackman coming to do Deadpool and Wolverine is that we're actually going to get to see who the new Wolverine's going to be.
Yep. All those Henry Cavill rumors / confirmation / rumors flying about. I agree with you that we're probably going to get a ton of cameos of people as Wolverine though. But here's the thing.
End up being like when we got to see John Krasinski as Mr. Fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was just internet service.
That's the thing. They keep teasing this other X-Men universe, that other universe in Multiverse of Madness where Charles Xavier is from, Beast and Miss Marvel showing up at the end of the Marvel the Marvels. This idea that in a specific universe they have your MCU X-Men showing up is something that I feel like is new. This before their most recent ideological reboot of the MCU that started when they rewrote some of Daredevil and retroactively made the Netflix shows canon, like this past year in the strike, they changed directions with what they're doing. This X-Men show was made before that. And I kind of had a theory, because they always talked about how when they do an X-Men movie, they want to explore characters that aren't overexplored in media, that maybe they were going to have this animated show be canon and have it explained as why in the early 2000s, the X-Men kind of completely faded out of popular interest and were gone for some reason, and that we were going to come back to new characters because those would all be much older in the 2020s, and we would do that kind of thing. And the events of episode 5 don't contradict the idea of that, and I'm very curious where they're going with this and how much consequence it's going to have.
There's also some sentiment that the reason the posters and everything look that way is that the Fantastic Four movie we're going to get is going to be set in the 60s.
Yeah, 100%.
In which case, if they branch off of that to X-Men.
Yeah.
We'll see. Yeah. A lot of future, but you know, it's been a good week. So, you know, go check out Civil War in theaters, check out Fallout on Prime Video, check out X-Men 97 on Disney Plus. You know, a lot of good stuff coming out now. It's been a fun spring, and that will continue next week as we get our second of three Dan Stevens movies this spring as Abigail. You know,
Abigail.
Guy, I'm so excited about that. You know what else? Zack Snyder is back with Rebel Moon Part 2. Is it the Scar Giver? I can't remember. I feel like they had a huge advertising push for Part 1 in December, and I have not seen a thing, and I just realized it drops on Thursday.
I saw one ad on Thursday that just said, watch Part 1. One ad that literally just said, Rebel Moon, without giving a subtitle, comes out this Thursday. Watch Part 1 now.
Like, it's been an interesting time for Netflix because, like, you know, I thought Ripley was really good. Three Body Problems
being really good. I'm so excited about Ripley. I've never seen The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a happy story, but
I don't know if I should or not. Like, if I should just
I'd probably just watch the series then, because if you've never seen the movie, you won't be comparing and you also won't know what's coming.
It would be a different perspective. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, and then you can probably watch the movie afterward. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, Talented Mr. Ripley is one of the movies that turns 25, so maybe a little bit later in the year, because it's 1999.
Also, on April 26th, they're doing special event releases of The Mummy for its 25th year. So,
I know, and getting ready to do episode 1. So, actually, next week we will be talking about Abigail and Rebel Moon, and then the following week, Challengers is out. We'll talk about episode 1, and we can talk about The Mummy, too. Just do a couple of 99 rewinds. George of My Jungle, Brendan Fraser.
Mm-hmm.
That's hard to believe that movie's 25 years old. It's gonna
make me yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Well, Luke Gino, and then Stephen, I can't remember, Summers, who did The Mummy.
Yeah.
And George Lucas.
We'll just like weigh the heavy scale, because there's no way that movie's not going to be super intense or some kind of emotional.
I'm gonna say I was rewatching because I'm, you know, for Star Wars, I'm doing my binge watch, my personal Star Wars rankings. I started a complete rewatch in chronological order. This yesterday, I watched 1, 2, 3 Solo, Rogue One.
Okay,
one, not the best. Not the worst.
Oh, no, it's not. Two is worst.
Two is, yes. And I will never forget watching listening to, if you ever loved the old Binge Mode podcasts, you know, they started, Mally Rubin and Jason Concepcion, they started out talking about Game of Thrones, and they went, you know, episode by episode through all of them. Then they went to Star Wars. And I remember, will never forget, when they're talking about episode 2, Jason Concepcion talking about the dialogue, saying it was clear from listening to this movie that George Lucas has never felt the touch of a woman.
Yep.
I cannot get that out of my mind when you watch this, like, horrendous. There's no other word for it, horrendous. Uh-huh. But despite that, there are still things in some of those movies they're good. Probably the best lightsaber battles in all of Star Wars are in the prequels.
Sure. Yeah.
Especially in 3, but
where there are 5 of them.
Well, even in episode one, you get one of the best pieces of music ever made in Duel of the Fates. Yeah. You get a really cool villain that they didn't know what to do.
You know what? Remind me when we talk about that movie to talk about Topher Grace's fan edit, because I'll probably throw in stuff about my own fan edits of the prequels. But
More, I have to be honest, the more you watch, if you watch them in chronological order, it's the same way I sort of feel about Harry Potter. Like, there is nothing wrong with the Sorcerer's Stone or Philosopher's Stone, depending on which version you of the book you read. But it's a kid's movie.
Yeah.
It's a kid's movie in a way that Azkaban On is not.
Yeah.
And I think the same thing about episode one. I think part of what rubs the wrong way is now this is going to be revealing my age, but in particular, like, I was two when Jedi came to theaters, so I didn't see any of those when they originally, but I watched all of them many times growing up, and then I went and watched in consecutive months the 97 reissues on the day. Mm-hmm. I remember getting permission to skip school to go see them come out. And so in May of 99, I was graduating from high school. I was psyched to see my first Star Wars movie in theater, and you had grown up with those, and this just was not what I was expecting.
The thing about George Lucas as a writer, one of the big things is he did miss an opportunity there to think everyone who's 10 years old when episode one comes out would be 13 when episode two comes out and 16 when episode three comes out, and to age the movies up with someone would have been so great for that trilogy. But we'll talk about that more.
Well, you guys, hope you have a wonderful weekend. Don't forget tax day tomorrow. It makes sense that we're talking about Civil War because taxes are coming. Until then, we will see you guys at the movies.